All right, we're doing Mishpatim. So the Eilah Mishpatim Asher Tassim Lefnehem. And these are the statutes. Mishpat. Mishpat is not just statutes. I guess the term statutes can refer to all the laws of the Torah. But it's a particular area of the Torah. And that is the jurisprudence, civil laws, laws governing relations between Ben Adam L'Chavera, between man and his friend, so to speak. That's the idea of Mishpat, that the society has to function in accordance with justice. All right, so right off the bat, you can ask a question, which is taken up by Chazal, and that is, these are the first laws that God gives to Moshe Rabbeinu. So question arises, why does the Torah begin with Mishpat? With Mishpat. And there's a Medrash that's quoted by the Ramban. This is the Ramban on Pasuk Aleph. V'yelah Mishpatim asher tasim lifnehem. So the Ramban quotes Medrash Rabbah. The Medrash Rabbah is on Shmos Lamed Tezvav. Kula Torah Kula Tluya B'Mishpat. That the entire Torah is contingent upon Mishpat. V'chein Nosan HaKadosh Baruch Hu Dinin Achar Aseres HaDibros. That's why God gave over these laws of jurisprudence after the Aseres HaDibros. If you take a look at the first Rashi on Mishpatim, V'yelah HaMishpatim, so Rashi raises the question, V'lom Nismucha Parshas Dinon L'Parshas Mizbeach. The Smichus Parshios, the juxtaposition of the Parshios. This is the Parsha of Dinim, of laws, monetary laws. It is associated with the last Parsha in the previous Sedra, which is Yisra, which talks about the Mizbeach. That the Mizbeach cannot be built with hewn stones, with kichar b'cha hinafto le'avatcha le'a, because you've lifted your sword over it and have disqualified it. That too is an interesting idea, that the metal can't be used in the construction of the Mizbeach. That's a separate idea, and we'll come back to that. But that's the last subject of the Parsha of Yisro, and that's immediately followed with Mishpatim. So what's the teaching? Lomerlach, to teach you, Shetasim Sanhedrin, Eitzel HaMikdash, that you should establish a Sanhedrin by the Mikdash. So, of course, that's an idea. I think it's associated with the concept that the Midrash Rabbah mentions. So let's see if we can understand that idea, that Kol HaTorah Kula, that the entire Torah is contingent upon Mishpat. What does that mean? Implying that there's something very unique about Mishpat, and that this seems to be the essential foundation of the perfection that the Torah is talking about. However, it would seem that there are things that transcend Mishpat. I think most people would say that they don't associate the idea of Mishpat, of justice, with religious perfection. Mishpat is something which is functional, which is practical. Obviously, it's necessary. You want to have an orderly society. But when you're talking about the perfection of the individual in terms of yadus, I don't think most people would associate that with Mishpat. What about the laws pertaining to Avodah Zarah? The laws pertaining to Yedias Hashem, to the knowledge of God, negation of Avodah Zarah, the areas of kedusha, of personal sanctity in terms of forbidden sexual relations, the areas of tefillah, Shabbos, the Yom Tovim, and so forth. Here we're saying that everything is contingent upon Mishpat. And then you have that other idea of the Yelah Mishpatim, which I think is related to this idea, that the Sanhedrin has to be located by the Mikdash. It's being suggested that if you don't have a social order, so then how can you have a environment in which you can practice the Torah? That point is correct. That's true, and there's no question that, that's one of the practical objectives, to have an orderly society. But that would seem to be an obvious point. I don't think that's the point of the Midrash. The point of the Midrash is teaching us something different, that is above and beyond that. It's not just a practical thing, that there's more, that Mishpat is at the essence of the perfection that the Torah seeks to bring about. The question over here is whether the significance of these laws that pertain to Mishpat, to Dinin, the civil laws, monetary laws, clearly, since they are given by God, they're going to be superior to any other system. But what is the ultimate role of these laws in terms of the objective of Yahadus, of true human perfection? Is it just a matter of practicality? That's what you would think. But the statement of the Midrash, that everything is toloi in Mishpat, that is to say, the entire fulfillment of the Torah in terms of obtaining perfection is toloi in Mishpat. That's the question that we're asking. Let's go through the Parsha of Eved Ivri. Maybe there's something in there that will shed light on this. Interestingly enough, the first subject of the Mishpatim, of these judicial statutes, monetary laws, is about something called Eved Ivri. Kisikna Eved Ivri. If you purchase an Eved Ivri. So the Prophet says, Sheish Shanim Yavod. He shall work for 6 years. Uvashvi Yetze Lachavshi Chinam. And on the seventh year, he shall go out free, into freedom. It's very important to study these psukim here with Rashi, because the way they're worded, it lends itself to different interpretations. For example, what is the meaning of Eved Ivri? Is this Eved literally a slave? Is this a Jewish person? Can a Jew become a slave? Or is it talking about a Gentile who belongs to an Ivri? Is it the Eved of an Ivri? Or no, it's an Eved Shehu Ivri. It's an Eved who is an Ivri. So Rashi addresses this question. So Rashi says, on base, Kisikna Eved Ivri, Eved Shehu Ivri. It's talking about an Eved who is an Ivri. So now we know that we learn something new, that there are two institutions of Avdus in the Torah. One is the Eved Kanani, the Gentile Eved. That can be more accurately translated as a slave. So the Torah does have an institution of slavery, Gentile slaves. I know that's very controversial, because our notion of slavery is that it's something terrible and inhumane and all of that. But we can't bring those attitudes towards the study of the Torah. The Torah's concept of slavery is a different concept. I'm not going into that, though, today. That's a good question to take up on another occasion. Because on the surface, people would have a question. How could the Torah permit Jews to actually participate in slavery? Well, it's based upon the fact that we're associating our slavery, the kind of slavery we've encountered in recent history, with the Torah's concept. But still, we should try and elucidate it. That's not what I'm doing today. Just know that there is a Gentile slave which really partakes, that's a true, more in conformity with the true slave, in the sense that he's the property of the master. The master has ownership of him, and he doesn't go out in 6 years. To the contrary, it's permanent, unless the master decides to free him. But there's no term on that. Here we're talking about a second type of slavery. It's really, the term slave over here is not good, because there's tremendous restrictions on the Jewish slave, the Eved Ivri. So therefore, I generally prefer to use the term servant, because it's more of a situation in which there's no true ownership of the individual, but he is subservient to him monetarily, that he has to work for the master. But there's tremendous restrictions placed upon the master, to the extent that he can't force him to do any type of backbreaking. I love this parach, any type of, not just backbreaking labor, but You have to go through the halachos. He has to treat the Rambam brings it down. He has to treat him with the greatest respect. He can't, for example, he can't force him to do harsh labor, as I said, avodas parach. Rambam says, lo savod bo avodas eved. He can't force him to do the labor of an eved. That would mean a slave. So even though he's called an eved, it's not a true slave. Eino noeg bo el kasachir. He can only treat him like a sachir. A sachir is someone who's a hired hand, who's hired himself out for labor, to do work. In general, the Rambam goes through what's considered to be harsh labor. And it's not just in terms of the physical difficulty or the fact that it's degrading, but any type of activity which the master wants them to do simply because he doesn't want it to be idle. Sometimes a person has, you know, if someone's working for him, there's nothing really to do. So a decent individual, let's say he hired somebody, and he anticipated that he hired him for 10 hours or something because he thought that he would need him. But then he finishes his work and there's 5 hours left. So a decent person wouldn't mind. Why should he force the guy to work just because he's paying for him if there's nothing really to do? But then there are people that it bothers them. A certain stinginess. They can't tolerate the idea that somebody else is making money off of them. It's a blow to their ego. Like they misjudge and it's costing them money. So in order to compensate for this, even though in reality it doesn't do anything, they try to make work. They create tasks so the person will look like he's still busy, so he won't be able to enjoy the fact that he's making money for doing nothing. There is such a mentality. That type of a thing, however, is prohibited. The master can't tell him to just rake the leaves over here until I come back. Or it's got to have a certain duration, it's got to have a certain limit to it. That is, he's got to describe the sum total of the work. So, because that's a torment for a person to just be doing things that aren't really necessary. It's degrading to a person. Or, where he doesn't have any end goal in mind. When a person is doing work, so it's a job, all right, maybe difficult, but he knows that at a certain point that's going to be the end of it. When a person is just working and it could be endless, he has no clue, so that's a psychological torment. So you see that he has to treat him with kid gloves, so to speak. He has to treat him with great gentleness. Not only that, it's also important to know that the Torah demands that the master treat the Eved, maintain him in the same style that he himself lives in, which is a very, very high standard. That is, he cannot have one style for himself, one standard of living for himself, and a lower one for the master, even if the lower one for the master would be fine. But if he's a wealthy person, and he's living on a wealthy estate, and he has a home in the city or in a different place, which is fine, but not on the same level, he cannot keep the effort in the other one. He's got a ke'imo. It's got to be on the same level. He's got to give him the same foods, even if he could give him other foods which aren't as wonderful. But no, he's got to give him the same thing. He cannot disparage him by treating him according to a lower level. That's why the famous Chazal, that if he only has one pillow, if there's only one pillow, he has to give it to the Eved. And he can't sleep on it. Because if he sleeps on it, so then he's violating the halacha. He's keeping the Eved on a lower level. So he has to give it to the Eved. Because there's no requirement of the Eved that the Eved has to be on the same level that he has to maintain the master. So therefore the only solution is to give it to the Eved. Therefore Chazal said that whoever acquires an Eved Ivri, it's as though he acquired a master for himself. So that's all by the way of background. That this is a different kind of an institution. And it's also one that the Torah has a great deal of ambivalence about, as you'll see. It's the kind of thing that we really don't want, but if it has to come to that, it's sort of the lesser of two evils. So let's take a look at it. So There's one more thing we have to establish. This is very, very important. And that is, how does a person become an Eved Ivri? Under what circumstances does a person become an Eved Ivri? It says, Kisikna, if you purchase. Purchase from who? Who's the seller over here? So take a look at Rashi. That's the second Rashi on Beis. Kisikna. Miyad Beisdin. From Beisdin. Shemachru Bignevaso. They sold him for his theft. Kemoshin Emer, as it says, Im Ein Lo, Vinimkar Bignevuso. That is, if this person stole, what's the Torah's punishment for stealing? The person steals money, he doesn't have to go to jail. Again, another illustration of the difference between the Torah system. So what is the punishment for theft? And this really is not much of a punishment. He simply has to repay. It's a monetary phenomenon. He took money illegally, so he's holding on to somebody else's money. So he has to give back the money. Okay, we're not talking now in terms of tshuva. In terms of tshuva, it's more than that. There's a difference between the statutes, the legal requirements. The legal requirements, he doesn't really have to do tshuva. He just has to restore. In certain cases, there's a knas, a fine, kefel. For a burglar, there's kefel. There's other cases where there's other kinds of knasos. So, worst case, in an ordinary case of burglary, he would pay back the principal, and if he doesn't confess, if he confesses, then that exonerates him from the fine. If, however, he fails to confess and he's found guilty by the court, so then in addition he pays the fine. The fine is the amount that he stole. If he stole $100, that's kefel. So then he has to pay $200 back. And all this makes sense because it's justice. That is to say, to merely pay back what you stole in and of itself would be lacking in terms of a punishment, if the individual at this point is in need of a punishment. Thus, if he confesses and he faces up to the consequences, he acknowledges that he's a thief, so therefore that exonerates him. That's considered to be somewhat of a punishment. But if he fails to do so, and he's found guilty by the court, so then there's the imposition of the fine. That also is something we can understand. Because if it was merely the case, if the law was merely that a person, when he steals, the most he could be subjected to was repaying what he stole, so there wouldn't be any element of deterrence, then it would be profitable, so to speak. What's the big risk? What do you have to lose? For an individual that was not restrained from doing so by the moral issues. So if a person didn't care about that, what would be the practical consequences? So it might be advantageous. So what do you have to lose? So you steal. If they don't catch you, you have the money. If they do, so you give it back. What are you losing? Therefore, there's the element of a fine. But it has to be that there's a risk. Now, the case we're talking about is someone who stole and does not have the ability to pay it back. He's essentially an impoverished individual. And that's probably why he stole. We're not talking over here about a violent criminal or a sociopath, a dangerous person. It doesn't seem to make sense because the question arises, why would anybody want to take such a person into their house? These are the kinds of questions that people ask when you study the parasha. Who would want to hire a criminal? That's a problem today. I mean, in America, even when a person leaves jail, he has a record. So people are reluctant to hire him. So, here it's more than hiring him, here you're taking the person into your house. So I'm going to say that we're not talking over here about violent people, we're talking about someone who was driven to it by poverty. And you see, he can't pay back, he can't raise the money to pay it back. So then Beis Din has the right to sell him as an Eved, and the money that is acquired, the purchase, is then used to pay back the victim. This is the only crime in the Torah which subjects a person to this penalty. There's no other crime. Even if it involves money, if you injured somebody else and damaged somebody else's property and your own money and you can't pay him back, Beis Din cannot sell you. It's only a case where the money that you owe has, because of that, is the fact that you stole. So now, that's one situation. There's another situation that the Torah talks about, kiyama chachicha. If your brother should become very downtrodden, if he's very poor, no, he doesn't steal. He hasn't stolen, but he's, I would say, similar to the other individual who steals. He's in a state of poverty, but he doesn't steal. He can't get by either. So he sells himself. He has the right to sell himself as an Eved. Because that situation is better than starving, or I guess becoming a beggar or whatever. So that those are the two situations in which a person could become an Eved. He sold himself, not because of crime, but because he can't get by. Or Bezdin sold him because of the crime of stealing and he can't repay. So then, of course, the question is, what's our parasha talking about? Because, by and large, most of the rules are the same in terms of what the master can do, what the master can't do, but there are differences, as we will see. There are certain significant differences in terms of the laws that apply, depending upon whether you became an Eved because you sold yourself, or because you were sold by Bezdin for the crime of theft, as you will see today. So Rashi wants to make the point that our parsha is talking about miyad bezdin, kisikna miyad bezdin, shemachru b'gnevuso. That our parsha is talking about the case where a person was sold by bezdin because of his theft. Then he says to prove it, al eino ela b'mocher atzmo b'nei dochako. Or perhaps you will say that it's talking about someone who sold himself because of his poverty. Aval machru bezdin lo yetze b'shesh. See, that's a key issue, because our parsha, one of the points it's making is that the person goes out after 6 years. So perhaps you'll say that that's if he sold himself, but someone who was sold by the bezdin for theft doesn't go out with six. So Rashi says, kishu omer, when it says v'chiyomach achicha imach v'nimkar loch, now this is in Vayikra, chafei lamates. When it says over there that if your brother becomes very poor and he sells himself to you, so that's harei mocher atzmo. That's a reference to someone who sells himself because of his poverty. So then what's the meaning of when you purchase? Because the Torah chose to describe the other situation, not from when you purchase, but from the standpoint of the individual who sells himself. So here we're talking about somebody else, someone who's purchased. That is, he didn't want to sell himself. He was purchased outside of his control. So it's talking about Benimkar Bebezdin. It's talking about one who was sold by the Bezdin. Now we proceed. Our parsha is talking about one who was sold by the Bezdin because of theft and an inability to repay it. If he could repay it, Bezdin cannot sell him. So the first thing we learn is that he works for 6 years and he goes out free on the seventh year. Now, Pasuk Gimel, in Begapo Yavo, Begapo Yetze. This is a famous quote. Everybody quotes that in various situations. Which means, if he comes in alone, he goes out alone. See, it's cryptic. What does that mean? If he comes in alone, he goes out alone. You have no way of knowing what the Torah is talking about. I defy anyone to explain this without reference to the oral law, to the Torah Sheba'al Peh. But that's the way the Torah is written in general. Nobody that wanted to communicate something in a specific manner would write a book this way. If you're writing a book this way, it presupposes that there's another source of information which is going to elucidate what the text is referring to. That is the Torah Sheba'al Peh. In Ba'al Ishahu, if he's married, the Yotza Ishto Imo, then his wife goes out with him. This is very, very cryptic. What are you talking about? If he's married, his wife goes out with him. What's the implication that if he's married, she too becomes a slave? So Rashi explains begapo. Essentially, the word itself, the implication is, it's related to the word beknafo, his garment. He just comes in by himself, with the clothing on his back, so to speak. So if he comes in alone, he goes out alone. What does that mean? So it's alluding to something. Rashi says, "Begapo yetze, magid she'im lohaya nosoi mitchila." It's telling you that if he was not married to begin with, ein rabo mosa lo shifcha kananas al karcho, then his master cannot give him a shifcha kananas. In order to sire from her slaves. So you learn something very, very interesting over here. The Torah now is referring us to the fact that there's a new development over here. And that when a person becomes an Eved Ivri, under certain circumstances, we'll soon see that there are two circumstances. Then the master has the right to give to him a Shifcha, Kenanis, which is a Gentile female slave, as a wife. A wife in this, a temporary kind of a wife. Not a true wife, but a wife in the sense that she becomes mutter to him in sexual relationship, and that's for the sake of producing children. That's very, very interesting for a number of reasons. Yeah, the question is that this is something which otherwise would be prohibited. It's a serious violation, a serious issur, to have sexual relations, to marry someone who's not Jewish. Now, the shifcha, of course, is not Jewish. And indeed, when we talk about marrying, it's not the usual kind of marrying in terms of kedushin. She doesn't become his wife in that sense. And when the term is up, he leaves her behind. But the question arises, what's the reason behind this? Why did the Torah, in this situation, why? What about the Isser? Why did it remove the prohibition against the Shifcha, which is a very serious one? And for all intents and purposes, when someone becomes an Eved Ivri, he's a Jew, he's chayiv in all the mitzvos, he has to perform all the mitzvos. And just an aside, the Shifcha Kenanis, for everybody's information, and this applies to an Eved, is not completely like an ordinary Gentile. There's a different status in that we say Shelo Asani Eved, Shelo Asani Gai. We make a differentiation. Actually, there's an elevation in the status of someone who's a slave. That's part of the explanation in terms of understanding the institution. But one who becomes a slave undergoes, if it's a male, undergoes mila, circumcision, and tefillah. And the person now obtains a new status. That is to say, that they are obligated in mitzvos. All mitzvos, the negative commands, and in terms of the positive commands, like a woman. That is, mitzvah say, shalo azman grama. Positive commands that are not dependent upon time, they fulfill. So, right off the bat, you could see that this is a very serious elevation in their status. They become someone who's performing mitzvos. And therefore, if the master frees them, they're automatically Jewish, with no need to go through gerus. So you see that this is sort of a transitional a phase in terms of becoming a Jew. If the master frees the slave, male or female, that person is automatically Jewish by virtue of being freed. So that casts some light upon the status. But meanwhile, this Shifcha is a Gentile woman, and she is prohibited to an ordinary Jew. So that's a question. What's the reason for this? So, however, you have to know, in order to understand this is really what we're going to seek to understand. This is something which does not apply to every Eved Ivri. There are two conditions which are required before this can happen. First of all, this is only speaking of, in this parasha, it's only talking about the Eved Ivri who became an Eved because of his theft and Beis Din sold him as a punishment. But it's not talking about Mocher Atzmo, the one who sells himself. That's the first thing. The second condition has just been referred to in our Pasuk. In Begapo Yavo, Begapo Yetze. That is, it's telling us indirectly that if he came in alone, he goes out alone. Which means to say that if he came in alone, if when he was sold as an Eved, he did not have a wife, then the master cannot give him the Shifcha. It's only talking about an Eved who, at the time he was purchased, was married to a woman. In that situation, the master has the right to give him a wife. For the purpose of having children, those children will then not be the children of the Eved. They're not going to be his children, even though he's the biological father. But in terms of halacha, it's not just biology. He's got to be, it's only those children that are Jews, that he has with a Jewish woman. Any children that a man has with a non-Jewish woman are not his children, according to halacha. He's not the father. So the children are avadim. They have the same status as their mother. They belong, as avadim, to the master. They're left behind. And of course, the wife is left behind. Because once he is no longer an Eved, he can't be with her. Because it's prohibited to be with a Shivcha. So of course the question arises, what's the reason? There are a number of questions. First of all, the whole idea is difficult to understand. Well, what's the purpose behind this? And why did the Torah remove something which ordinarily would be a very serious restriction, a very serious Isser? That's the first question. The second question would be, if that is the case, for whatever reason, that in that situation of being an Eved, one can marry a Shivcha, then more specifically, why is it only if the person became an Eved because he was sold? What difference does that make? Why wouldn't it apply equally if he became an Eved because he sold himself because of his poverty? That's the second question. And thirdly, specifically now in the case where it is permitted, that is, someone who was sold by Beis Din, why is it that it's only if this individual had a wife in the first place, then the master can give him the shivcha. But if he was single, the master cannot. If anything, I think most people's reactions would be that it should be the opposite. People have a difficulty accepting that. If he's already married, so doesn't this constitute some type of a pain for the first wife? And if he's not married, so then most people would think that's more appropriate in that situation. But here we see precisely the opposite. That it's only if he's married already, then the master can have rishus to give him the shivcha. If he's single, then that's the meaning of the pasuk. We've elucidated it down. Begapo yavo, if he enters it into the situation single, begapo yetze, he's going to go out single. That is to say that he's not going to acquire a wife in the interim. Question on the pasuk is imbal ishahu. If he's married, v'yotza ishto imo, his wife goes out with him. What is that saying, his wife goes out with him? Why would we think that she doesn't go out with him? In what sense are we talking about? Does that mean that she became a slave? And we, not only that, but that she would not go free. She would have to serve a longer term than her husband. She's not committed a crime here. Take a look at Rashi. V'yotza ishto imo, v'chimi echnisa, shetetze. So Rashi asks, who brought her in? That she needs to go free. How did she become a Eved? Elo magid akasev, but the pasuk is telling you something else. Shakon Eved Ivri, that one who purchases an Eved Ivri, chayev mzonos ishto uvanav. He's obligated in support. He now assumes the support of his wife and his children. So what is the meaning of v'yotza ishto imo? Yeah, it means she's removed, not from the situation of being an Eved, from the benefit. She goes out, meaning she loses the benefit. That's something you couldn't figure out from the pasuk, because you would have no way of knowing what it's talking about, since you wouldn't have any way of knowing this fact, that the master assumes the responsibility. See over here a reflection of the Rachmanus, of the tremendous compassion and mercy within this institution, that it's really for the benefit of this individual, and it relieves him of a tremendous responsibility. The burden of having to support his family now falls upon the master. It's interesting that somebody asked the question, why does the Torah choose to teach you this point through the negative? That is to say, it doesn't tell you in the positive that if you purchase an Eved, you're obligated to support the family. It doesn't tell it to you that way. It hints at it. You have to deduce it. It only tells it to you by telling you that when it ends. So that is to say that when he leaves, the support for his wife terminates. That's basically what the Torah is telling you. It's only telling it to you through the termination, from which I deduce that therefore he was obligated in the first place, which is unusual. Why doesn't it tell you in a positive way? In my opinion, it's an opinion. type of an answer, I can't say for sure or definitively why the Torah chooses to reveal this information in this particular way. But I think it's by telling it to you this way, it's conveying the whole philosophy behind it, the reason for this. And it's an expression of the tremendous compassion. The Torah is referred to as Rachmana, compassion. What's the reason for this requirement? The Torah has an ambivalent attitude towards the institution, as we'll see later on. If he re-enlists, the Torah tries to discourage him, but if he re-enlists, his ear has to be pierced. Because it's something which is not the ideal, avadayim, that the Jews should be avadim only to Hashem, and not take upon themselves another master. Because to the extent that they develop this dependency on another human, on another individual, to that extent it takes away from their relationship with God in a very serious kind of a way. But nevertheless, the Torah doesn't prohibit it. Because this situation is one which does not represent the ideal, but under certain circumstances it just may become necessary because of the alternatives. A person can find himself in a terrible situation and he needs, for a short period of time, he needs an opportunity to sort of rehabilitate himself, so to speak. So the real goal is that this should be temporary. But if for whatever reason it can't be, the Torah permits him to remain there. But everything that's done over here is done from the standpoint of compassion. For example, in the case where the person is sold as an eved, you see the difference between the Torah approach to a situation and between our society's approach. For example, the person steals in America, he's subject to jail. He goes to jail. Okay, so that may be, let's assume that in the society that's what he deserves. Let's assume that. As we've seen, the Torah's penalty is really he has to pay back the money. So in our society, he goes to jail. Fine. But what happens to his wife and family, his children? What happens to them? They didn't commit a crime. Well, you could say that there's nothing we could do. No one's complaining about that because when you enact justice, when you punish someone, there's going to be consequences to innocence. There's no way to avoid that. You can't avoid that phenomenon unless this person has no connection to anyone. But if he's a father, if he has children, if he has family, people depending upon him, so they're going to be affected. And there's nothing that the courts can do about that, because otherwise you wouldn't have any system of justice. But there is an element there of something taking place which is unfair, so to speak, inequitable, even though there's nothing you can do about it. But you see, the Torah over here, in its treatment of the situation, took into consideration something else, the effects that this would have upon his family. And to put him in a situation which, on the one hand, is necessary in order to pay back, but on the other hand, which would be very hurtful, which could destroy his whole family. Because if he goes off to work for the master, now what's going to happen to his wife and children? They have to fend for themselves. So that's going to destroy the family. Maybe she would get a divorce, whatever the case may be. So you see that the Torah over here incorporated the desire to not to destroy, not to break up his family. That's why the Pasuk expresses that in Baal Ishahu, if he's a married person that we're selling into this institution, and your concern will be, so what's going to happen to his whole family? Why is the Torah putting him in a situation like this? Maybe it's necessary for him, and maybe it's helpful on one level, but it's going to destroy him on a different level. V'yotza ishto imo, his wife will go out with him. Meaning to say that the Torah took into consideration the need to preserve the family. The Yotza Ishto Imo, that she remains together with him, that's expressing the objective. It's telling you about the phenomenon by virtue of the fact that she leaves from this benefit, but Imo with him, it chose to tell it to you this way, because by telling it to you this way, it expresses the whole purpose of what it's all about. It's just been pointed out to me that the Ramban says this very same idea. So it's like we say, Baruch Shekevanti. It's great thing if you say an idea and it's the same idea that was stated by our great Rabbeim, our great teachers. So he says, "V'chol zeh chemla mayeis Hashem aleihem." All of this is mercy from God on them. V'ala eved, and on the eved shlo yomos b'tzaro, that he should not die in his pain. V'yos omlo b'veis nachri, where he's working in a stranger's house. U'vona v'yishto yu nezavim, and his wife and children are abandoned. The next pasuk, im adonav yiten lo isha. Now it's telling you openly about the right of the master to give him a wife. If his master shall give him a wife, as Rashi says, mikan sharashus biyad rabo limso lo shifcha kananis. From here we see that the master has the right to give him a shifcha kananis, laholid men avadim, to sire avadim. And then he raises the question, well, how do you know it's talking about a shifcha who's the wife? Maybe it's talking about a Jewish woman. Oh, ain't no Eli be Israelis. Or perhaps it's talking about a Jewish woman. How do we know that it's not talking about a Jewish woman? Talmud Lomar, Isha viladeo tiyoladonel. That the woman and her children shall belong to the master. Ha'ainu medaber el b'knanis. So therefore it must be speaking about a Gentile. Shareho ivriya afhi yotza b'sheish. Because if you're talking about a Jewish woman who's also, and there would have to be someone who's also an Eved, which is called Amo Ivriya. So this institution of Eved Ivri can apply to a girl as well. But you can't say that it's talking about an Amo Ivriya, because she too goes out with six. And even she goes out before 6 years, if she brings signs of maturity. So therefore, it's talking about a Gentile, a Shifcha Kenana. So here the Torah is openly telling us that the master has the permission to do so. If that is the case, so Isha Viladeha, then the woman and her children, Tia Ladoneha, shall belong to her master, Ruhu Yete Bagapo, and he goes out alone. So the next parasha talks about someone that doesn't want to go to freedom, which in and of itself tells you something, that this institution can't be that evil that the person would resist leaving it and wants to stay. But that's a separate point. For today, we want to focus on this whole issue about the master having the right to give him the shifcha. There's many questions, as we've stated. And here, also, there's another element of ambivalence. On the one hand, we're talking about the tremendous compassion that the Torah took into consideration, the emotional needs of the Eved, his psychological needs, the sensitivity, you can't force him to do degrading labor, and you have to maintain him on a very high standard, and in certain circumstances you'd have to deprive yourself rather than afflict him, tremendous compassion. Then we see something which appears to be just the opposite, that he can give him this wife and puts him in a situation where he's going to produce children by her, and then when 6 years is up, he leaves her behind, and he has to leave his children behind. That seems to be something which is not so compassionate. But we're not really attacking it necessarily from that angle, where we were attacking it from a different angle, and that is to say that why in the first place is the Torah creating this heter, this permission to do something which in general is considered to be something which is a serious isser? And why is that only in the case of someone who was sold by Beis Din? And there too, only if he was already married, but if he's not married, then the master can't do it. We're going to try and see if we can resolve some of these questions. One of the strongest questions we've raised is this whole idea of giving the shifcha to the Eved for the purpose of having children. Now, that idea in and of itself is not really bothersome to me, if you didn't have the halachic problem that ordinarily there's a serious prohibition in terms of the arayos, the forbidden sexual relations. If you didn't have that problem, then the idea itself is not problematic to me. Because, as we've seen, the master, the so-called master, he's a very benign type of a master, has to treat the Eved with the greatest consideration, with the greatest respect,
You see from this, by the way, aside from it, we haven't really emphasized it, how important it is. The Torah has treated this whole thing with the utmost regard for the dignity of the Eved. And as we've seen, the master cannot subject him to any type of degradation, not just physical, but from the psychological standpoint, to the extent that he has to maintain him in the same style that he lives himself, so that the Eved cannot experience any sense of inferiority. So that's a very important lesson that the Torah is teaching us, that in terms of respect for the dignity of an individual, how important that is in the entire functioning of a person. That being the case, considering also that, as we learned yesterday, that the master not only has to be concerned about the Eved on this plane, but he has to be concerned about the wife and the children of the Eved, which means he assumes responsibility for them. So that this entails significant responsibilities of a monetary nature. And we explain the reason for that. The compassion in terms of preserving the relationship. Or, as the Ramban explains, that the Eved himself should not have to be in a state of anxiety that nobody's taking care of his family. Now, this burden is assumed by the master. So, to me, it makes sense that the master should have certain rights as well. Of course, we have to put ourselves into the context in which a person was able, according to the Torah, to have slaves. We haven't explained that institution. And he has female slaves, and he has the possibility of obtaining more slaves. By giving over the shivcha to someone who will have children, and these children will belong to him. So therefore, as far as that's concerned, if it weren't for the halachic problem, if he now had two different kinds of slaves, he had this Gentile slave and he has the Eved Ivri, the Jewish servant, so to speak, which is a different type of enslavement, and he could mate them, we could arrange a marriage between them, and the produce children, according to the legal system, according to halacha, the children would then be regarded as slaves, and they would belong to the master, and therefore he would increase his holding in terms of these slaves. To me, that's not a problem, because it makes sense that he should have certain benefits, certain compensation. However, so I'm not dealing with that issue. I'm not dealing with other issues that people raise in the sense that it goes contrary to our sense of propriety that the master should have such a control over the Eved in terms of something which is so private, that is to say, to have an arranged kind of a wife or an arranged kind of a marriage. And as the Rambam says, he can give the shivcha to the Eved, he can coerce him, so to speak. Coerce him in the same way that he's obligated to perform legitimate kinds of labor, the labor that he has to do for his master. In the same sense, this is an obligation that the Eved has to do. So he really doesn't have much choice in this matter. And to say that I don't want to mate or to marry, it's a different kind of a marriage, obviously, the shivcha. He doesn't have that right. I'm not taking up those kinds of issues right now as to what the justification is, or if somebody should be troubled by the fact that it seems strange that somebody else has the power, not just in terms of directing you to work, that we understand. If you hire yourself out for work, then you're obligated to do the work. But the idea of being forced to mate, so to speak, with this Gentile woman for the sake of having children, I can understand that that might go contrary to people's feelings about how these things work. And it can be explained in accordance with the true values of the Torah. I think it's based upon a misunderstanding that people have due to the effects of assimilation, being in this type of society we are, and we have very romanticized types of notions with regard to sexuality and the sex act and so on and so forth. I think people have lost sight of the true Torah philosophy with regard to these matters. I'm not going to get into that right now. We're going to approach this from a different angle. The question that I'm raising is not an emotional question, the emotional effect of coercing the Eved to do this. I'm raising the question, though, from the standpoint of halacha, that this must be something significant because the Torah has gone out of its way, so to speak, by making a tremendous exception to a very significant prohibition, which would prevent any Jew from having sexual relations with a Gentile woman, with a shifcha. So what's the reason for that? And it's very hard to explain it on the basis of the fact that it's a benefit to the master. That makes sense if there was no halachic problem, obstacle in the way. So from that standpoint, fine, let the master get some benefit out of this. It's one of the incentives in terms of obtaining an Eved Ivri. But just because of that, that seems trivial in terms of removing what would be a very serious isser in the realm of the arayos, the forbidden sexual relationships. So I think that the answer is to be found right in the pasuk itself. Take a look at pasuk Dalad. The pasuk says, if the master shall give him a wife, and of course the purpose is that she'll give birth to sons or daughters, ho'isha viladeha, the woman and her children, tieladoneha, shall belong to the master, v'hu yetze begapo, and he will go out alone. This itself is expressing the entire purpose, the entire philosophy that is behind this. And that is to say that, roughly speaking, what we're talking about, it seems to me, is analogous to the idea that the Rambam elucidates, that when a person goes to one extreme in terms of a defect with regard to one of the emotional dispositions, the Rambam says that a person should adopt the middle course, so to speak, not go to extremes of indulgence or even extremes of denial. And then he says when a person goes off the track and becomes attached to one of the extremes, so he expresses what the cure is, how the person is to go about curing himself, and he basically has to adopt the other extreme, which generally speaking is the wrong thing to do, but in terms of a cure, until the person has uprooted the attachment to the false extreme. So sometimes the person has to go to the opposite extreme. This is not exactly what's happening over here, but I think it serves as analogous. There's an analogy over here. It's also analogous, in my opinion, to the idea, which people have a difficulty with on the literal level, of ayin tachas ayin, shein tachas shein, an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth. And many people have misunderstood this. The Christians, for example, say this is Old Testament justice. It's a vengeance of some type. Of course, anybody that knows Torah knows that it's not applied in a literal way. It never was. Torah Shebaal Peh tells us that what it really means is the monetary restitution. So there was never ever a time in Jewish history that any court ever implemented this type of thing in a physical way. It was always monetary. However, of course, the question arises, if that's the case, what about the Torah Shevach Sav, the scripture? Why did it express it that way if that's not the intention? Why didn't it say money? Why did it express itself this way, thus creating the possibility of a false impression? And the Rav, Zichron Levracha, Rav Soloveitchik, said that, and this is very, very important, that Ayin Tachas Ayin, in terms of the literal meaning, is true. It's expressing a true idea. The true idea is not with regard to the halachic system of how it's to be implemented, but there's a concept over there. The Torah is telling us that it's not a matter of monetary compensation. In an ideal system, the person really, who had such a complete, absolute disregard of the other person's feelings, of his significance, to remove an eye from somebody else is such a negation of the validity of a different existence and such a complete focusing on one's own egotistical needs to the extent that he can't recognize any validity of another human being. So what is the appropriate reaction? What is the appropriate punishment? Insofar as punishment has a meaning in terms of rehabilitating the person, this goes contrary to everybody's emotions, but in truth, that's exactly what he should experience. He should go through that experience. Now you know what it's like. A person shouldn't have to go through these experiences in the first place to have a respect for the value of somebody else's existence, that anyone with a certain amount of intelligence and a reasonable type of a modesty will recognize that other people feel no differently than you. Their feelings are just as important to them as your feelings are to you, and that you do not have any superiority over any other individual, and you can't mistreat another person. Now, people do that all the time on every possible level, and they seem to downgrade. It's not that, well, why is he making such a big deal? It's nothing. People are always saying that it's nothing when it comes to somebody else's suffering. Of course, when it comes to their own, then it's not only is it something, but it's very, very significant. How could they possibly treat me that way? That's a mistake that people make. It's a serious defect to regard their own feelings in a light which is different than they would regard somebody else's feelings. That's not that important. Which means you're really demeaning their whole life is not that important, their whole existence is not that important. That's really at the bottom of that whole chain of thinking. Of course, when a person experiences what they're talking about, what they're going through, then it has a whole new meaning for them. You find that very often, even doctors sometimes. They become kind of, they have to, I guess, to a certain extent, develop a certain callousness, perhaps, to certain kinds of illnesses. But therefore, it becomes very abstract to them. It may become difficult for them to empathize with their patients. However, if a person experiences the same thing themselves, and they're in that same situation, then they have to actually feel all of the particular emotions that such a person feels, and all of the degradation or whatever goes along with it. The blow to their own ego and sense of confidence, then they have a newfound regard, a newfound respect for what the other people have to suffer. And that can have a significant effect upon their lives. So, to start off with, it shouldn't be necessary for somebody to experience the suffering that somebody else is going through in order for him to have the correct attitude, to be sympathetic, empathetic to it. Because our own mind dictates this to be true. And we should live on the level of mind. We shouldn't have to go through every experience in the world in order to understand it. However, unfortunately, there are people that don't utilize the mind in that direction. Their emotions dominate them. And they do allow that emotion, that their life is the only one that counts. The other person's life is really nothing. So to the extent that they could actually inflict a serious wound on that person, it doesn't really bother them. So to what the Torah is saying, Ayin Tachasai. This is really what you need. In terms of your soul, this would be the best thing. You have to go through the experience itself and know what it's like to have such a wound inflicted upon you. However, it's due to God's compassion that God is teaching us what the ideal is, but given human nature and given the emotions of people, God decided that this is not the way it should be implemented. It wouldn't work on a practical level. But nevertheless, the idea has to be taught. The idea is true. Now, I think that we can understand what's happening over here in a similar vein. The individual who engages in the act of theft really has a problem in terms of respecting the property rights of another individual. Has to go through the same thing. It's a negation of the rights of the other individual in terms of ownership, in terms of property, what belongs to him. That's why this is the only case in which, the only crime, for example, in which a person can be sold as an eved. And it has many, many meanings. Merely being sold as an eved forces him to acknowledge the rights of the master. In many ways, he has to work for him. And so on and so forth. With this particular situation effectuates this objective in a more specific way. Because if he is to marry this woman, then he's going to have a strong sense that this is his, it's his wife. We're putting him in a situation where, from an emotional standpoint, he's going to feel this belongs to me. But he's going to be forced to acknowledge the idea of true ownership, that true ownership is an abstract concept. And a person has to be able to live in accordance with the abstract concept. He can't live with the emotion of the moment. And that's probably what motivated him to steal in the first place, the emotion of the moment. He felt he needed something, so he could take it. He couldn't recognize the institution of bailus, the rights of bailus, the rights of ownership. He negated that entire thing because of an emotion. He has to be able to overcome that emotion and to replace that with a respect for the abstract concept of true ownership. So this is the real test. Now he's being placed in a situation where from every emotional standpoint, he feels ownership. First of all, with regard to the woman, but much, much more so with regard to the children. Because the shivcha starts out as someone who belongs to the master. It is true then that once he begins to live with her, and as man and wife, on whatever level, he begins to feel a certain sense of ownership. That's one thing. So the Isha, after that period of time, he has to give up the Isha. He has to renounce that which he feels he's legitimately entitled to in favor of the rights of the other person, which is based upon true ownership. That's the real cure for the sin of stealing. How much more so with regard to the children? Because here, he's clearly going to feel that it's his children. These children didn't belong to the master. So from every emotional standpoint, he's the one who produced these children together with his wife. So he's going to now have to walk away from these children and he's going to have to overcome his emotional attitude towards what's properly his in favor of the abstract concept of bailus. That's the real cure for the disease of theft. And that, I think, is the reason why that is the case. And, of course, we still have to deal with the question, but what about the existence of the Isser? This is a very nice idea, and it makes a lot of sense. And the Pasuk is telling you that. It's right there in the Pasuk. The whole idea was setting him up, so to speak. The whole idea of creating this marriage and producing these children is so that they will go back to the master, and he will have to relinquish them. In that act of relinquishing them, he will have to face up to his own emotions and overcome his emotions, and he'll be cured from the disease of theft. So now we can understand the whole institution of Eved Ivri in a different light. But still we have to confront the halachic prohibition. To answer this question, I think we have to go back to the original question that we raised at the beginning of the shir, the Eila Mishpatim, which is the statement of Chazal that everything is tali b'mishpat, that everything is contingent upon justice. The entire Torah is contingent upon justice. And we raise the question, what about the other aspects of the Torah? Those things that pertain to the relationship between man and God, the prayer and kashrut and keeping of the Shabbos and all of those mitzvos that seem to really be associated with the religious observance of a person as opposed to maintaining civil order, which is what Mishpatim seems to be about. And the Medrash is telling us that no, that the Mishpat is really the essence of what the Torah is all about. And the answer is because the real perfection of an individual has to do with overcoming that egotism, that so-called narcissism, that selfishness. This is not a religious system in the ordinary sense. Religion itself can be a very selfish, ego-gratifying type of a phenomenon for many, many people. Because you do have the experience very frequently of very seemingly pious, religiously observant individuals who do not act in the respectful, or just, appropriate manner in other areas of their life. It can be a very, very self-gratifying kind of thing. It gives a person a sense of goodness. He feels good. He feels protected. He feels secure. The essence of Yahadus is the perfection of the individual, the overcoming of all of the instinctual drives, and that in every area of his life he should live in accordance with justice. He should live in accordance with truth. That's the only way in which he can perfect his soul. And that's the only way in which he can have any kind of a relationship to God. It's got to be on the basis of truth. But if it's not, if he's engaged in satisfying all of his instincts, and the only purpose of being religious is so, to the contrary, it should be another support for his instincts, he shouldn't feel any guilt. The whole element of guilt should be removed. That's what happened in the time of the first Beis HaMikdash, when the sacrificial system becomes a means of giving people a false sense of security. You can do whatever you want to do, then bring your carbon, and you have a forgiveness. That's the way it works in other religions, by the way. Today, you have all of these mobsters, mafioso, and so on and so forth. They're all devout churchgoers. They go to the church, they belong to the church, they get the sacrament, and so on and so forth. They can confess. And it doesn't bother them. There's no conflict. There's no contradiction. What does one thing have to do with the other? You live your life as you want to live your life, and you get some kind of an absolution. That's an absolute falsification. You see that the essence is really mishpat. If a person cannot perfect himself in this area, because this is the area where all the selfishness comes out, this is the greed part of man. And the other emotions, for example, if you got to forbidden foods, those things can be dealt with. And even with regard to forbidden sexual relations, which are very, very powerful, those things can be dealt with. That's not the real essence of the challenge of being religious and observing the Shabbos and saying the tefillot and davening and all of these different things. That is not the essential struggle. That's very, very important. But it's only if it's the foundation. The foundation is where a person is able to grapple with the essential struggle, and that's with the selfishness, with the greed, with taking advantage, because that's what it's all about. That's what a person, most people are living their lives for, to promote themselves, to get ahead, to gratify their own desires, their own needs. So that all is on the foundation of justice. That's the idea of mishpat, and there are two different realms in the Torah. There's the realm of dinei mamonos, and then there's the realm of what we call iser. The monetary is dinei mamonos, the realm of iser v'heter, the prohibited and the forbidden. It's a different realm, and it operates by different laws in terms of halacha, how you apply it. Different rules apply. But if you ask which one has the greater significance in terms of the perfection of an individual in achieving the objective of what the Torah is trying to achieve, so it could be that the point over here is the realm of mishpat. The realm of mishpat is the foundation. And if a person is crooked in the realm of mishpat, then all of the other elements of yahadus, which have to do with the areas where he's not in conflict with fellow man, just the observance of the so-called rituals, cannot be effective. They can't achieve their purpose. That, I believe, is why Chazal say that the Sanhedrin has to be placed outside, actually in the realm of the Migdash itself. Because you can't have a Migdash without a Sanhedrin. That if a person does not subscribe to the rules of justice of the Sanhedrin, then the Migdash will not achieve its purpose, but it'll destroy the Migdash. Because then the Migdash becomes an opportunity to whitewash and to give a person a sense of security when he's really living a crooked existence. So now I just want to put everything into perspective. We've now explained many, many things. That's why it seems to me that we can explain why the institution of giving over the shifcha to the Eved only applies in the case of someone who became an Eved because he was sold by the Beis Din, because he stole for the crime of stealing. However, if he sold himself because of poverty, in that case, the master cannot give him over a shifcha. The basic prohibition remains in effect. That is in line with what we're saying, that this is part of the process of rehabilitation of the Eved for the crime of theft. In the other case, there's no crime involved. The Torah allowed him to become an Eved because of the situation of poverty. He had no alternative. But there's no basis for the permission, since he didn't commit the crime, and since the entire idea, the entire objective of the Shifcha is so that he'll learn to recognize and respect the institution of Bailus even though emotionally it goes against his grain, that's when he confronts the emotion and he overcomes the emotion. So that applies only to someone who stole. It also makes sense that this, another condition has been established, and that is in Begapo Yevo, Begapo Yetze, that if he enters into the situation single, without a wife, then the master cannot give him the shifcha. I think the reason for that is because there's another objective over here. The Torah has to balance off its objectives. It's true that the point of having this wife and having the children is so that he'll have to give them up and respect the rights of ownership. But that's not going to come into the picture. It may not be successful in a situation where he comes in without a wife. When he comes in without a wife, there's another danger. And that is that since he doesn't have a wife and he is given this wife, he may become attached to her. And the objective is that he should leave. We don't want him to remain as an eved. We want him to resume a normal existence. This is considered to be a defective state, even though it's permitted if there's no alternative. So therefore, the danger in that case would be that he really would become attached to his wife because he doesn't have a wife. And he really would become attached to the children because he doesn't have children, and therefore he just might decide to stay. If he did that, then first of all, it wouldn't achieve its objective, because the objective is he should leave. So if he leaves, we assume he has something to go back to. But if he has nothing to go back to, then he wouldn't leave. So A, it wouldn't achieve its objective. Moreover, it would be contrary to the ultimate objective of the whole institution, is that it should be temporary. It should be a curative measure to give him an opportunity to, so to speak, be rehabilitated and to get back on his feet and to leave. So that is why, in my opinion, it's only operative in a situation where he already had a wife. He already has children. Well, he doesn't have to have children. He has to have a wife. But that's the concept behind it. The concept is that he already has a family, so he doesn't want to stay here forever. Of course, you can, obviously, the Torah has taken into consideration that even in this situation, he may not want to leave, because that's what the next pasuk says, that if he says, I love my master, I love my wife, I love my children, I don't want to go free. So you see from there that even when he already has a wife, the danger of becoming attached to the situation and becoming attached to the shifcha as a wife and to the new children so that he doesn't want to leave and he wants to remain in Eved is still possible, still exists. And that's an imperfect situation. So, to begin with, however, the Torah did not want to set it up in a way where that it's going to increase the possibilities for that to come out. That is to say, if he didn't have a wife at all, then the chances of him remaining there and not leaving would be that much greater. So that's where the Torah drew the line. But it all fits into this concept that we've been elucidating. And it seems to me that this is the idea that is being reflected over here. That here there's a choice, there's a conflict between two objectives. One is with regard to the Isser Arayos. There exists a forbidden sexual relationship. That's one Isser. On the other hand, there exists a defect with regard to the person's basic approach to the arena of mishpat, of justice. He has a serious defect in terms of his ability to act justly, to refrain from theft. It seems that in this conflict, the importance of perfecting oneself in the arena of mishpat wins out and overrides the significance of observing this particular expression of the Isser Arayos. So that's why, in this case, the Torah created an exemption from something which would be forbidden on the basis of the prohibited sexual relations, because it's for the sake of perfection in the most vital area, in the area of mishpat, which everything is contingent upon that. And if you don't have a solid foundation in the area of mishpat, then all of the other area, all of the laws that pertain to the prohibited and the permitted, and all the areas that pertain to the so-called religious in terms of an adam lamakam, are going to be impossible to fulfill their objective, and to the contrary, they can serve as something which facilitates a person becoming even more corrupted. If a person does not have a correct foundation in Mishpat, then all of his religious observances can have a contrary purpose. And it can have a negative purpose, because they just provide that person with that false sense of religiosity, with that false sense of protection, which enables them to go further and further along the path of injustice. So I think that is the basic idea of the Eved Ivri, and that is the basic explanation of the Eila HaMishpatim, that everything is contingent upon Mishpat, and that's why the first set of laws that were given to Moshe after the Aseret Dibros were those pertaining to Mishpat.